Welcome to Jeffrey Zeldman's Awesome Internet Design Panel. This was originally called Jeffrey Zeldman's Awesome Panel. And when they approved it, they said, could you please put in an adjective? So we gave them two, awesome, internet and design. I guess design's not an adjective.
No.
I'm blowing it already. I'm 30 seconds into this. Last year, we said we were going to have a panel on the future of publishing. And they gave us a very small room, and we couldn't fill it. So this year, we said we were going to talk about unicorns and pixies. Welcome to South by Southwest. Now, at my side is Daniel Mall, who many of you know. He's a senior designer at Big Spaceship in New York, a Brooklyn art director. He's a technical editor at A List Apart magazine, co-founder of Typedia, and an instructor at the Miami Ad School. Beside him is Mandy Brown, community director at Typekit, co-founder and editor of A Book Apart, editor of A List Apart magazine. And beside me is Roger Black, graphic designer, creator of a new publication format for the web called Tree Saver, co-founder of WebType, co-founder of Font Bureau, and many other businesses. I also have a note that the East Side Cafe is a nice place to eat. I just took that note. Yes? Do I have a yes on that? Okay, very good. So today we're going to be talking about topics including platforms. Like, are we going back to the 90s between native, web, hybrid? Which platforms are we going to support? Welcome, it's the 90s all over again. Web fonts, we have Typedia, we have WebType. Mobile is the new widescreen, how to succeed in the new publishing. Responsive design, HTML5 or HTML. East Coast versus West Coast beefs, and many other topics. If time permits, we will even ask the question, whatever happened to, and then old timers who've been coming to South by Southwest for a long time can reminisce about bloggers they have known. Okay. Glad it's going well so far. 2 minutes into it. Okay. I want to start by telling you a little story. So I came here, and I was on my way to divorce court the day before I came here, and I have an app called TripIt, and TripIt said, you may be able to check into your flight to Austin. And I thought, that's a nice distraction, I'll do that. So I opened the app, and it said, and I clicked, and the app worked beautifully, and I clicked so that I could go to my log into my airline and get my boarding pass. I thought, man, it's so great to be living in the future. Here I am in a cab, downtown New York. Tomorrow, you know, it's cold and rainy, and tomorrow I'll be in Austin. This is awesome. And when they took me to JetBlue's website, I was presented with JetBlue's exciting website, which has just had a $1 million redesign. And the login process was entirely in Flash, which is not supported on my iPhone. So I had an iPhone app tell me to check in on the web, and then couldn't. Your thoughts, Mr. Mall?
So I think this is kind of like bait that Jeffrey's trying to bait me in on. I think for those of you who know me, I have an affinity towards Flash. I still do projects in Flash, and I do projects that are not in Flash. And the reason for that is because I started doing Flash work before I knew how to do anything. So I knew how to animate in Flash, I knew how to code in Flash, but I didn't know how to put that stuff on the web. So from there, kind of my background is I started learning HTML because I realized, oh, this is how you make a web page, and this is how you put that Flash stuff on the web. And from there, just kind of hacked through, learning CSS, learning how to splice up tables. And I think a lot of the web kind of started that way, where I think, you know, how many people kind of started that way, just like figuring stuff out and hacking through stuff? Yeah, this is perfect. And I think that's kind of where we are right now, right? Where we're returning to, like Jeffrey said, we're returning to kind of like the early 90s, the late 90s and the early 2000s, where people are just figuring stuff out. And we see a lot of sites that were, you know, best viewed in Netscape 5 or best viewed in Internet Explorer 6. And I think the difference now is that that wasn't a choice back then. It was people had a browser installed on their systems, and that's how they knew how to browse the internet. Like, my mom opens the internet, she clicks the blue icon to open the internet, and that's how she works. But now, we're sort of at the same place where we get best viewed in iPad, best viewed on iPhone, best viewed, but no one puts that on the device, and I think the difference is because we're sort of like choosing the type of experience that we want by doing it. So I buy an iPad because I have a particular type of experience with an app, with a site, with something on an iPad. I buy an iPhone because I want to see something in that context. I use Chrome because I want to see sites in a particular way. And I think that's a really powerful thing. I think that's something where we are able to choose how we want to experience a product, whether it's a Flash site or it's an iPad app or it's a mobile app or a native app, and we get to choose that experience. So we're sort of like tinkering through again, and we're figuring out, well, I can build an iPad site, and it is best viewed on iPad, but we have the ability to add that context and that content to people who want to experience it that way.
That's interesting, Dan. It seems to me that you're talking about two different perspectives at the same time. One is the perspective of consumers who make these choices. I want to sit back on my couch, so I'll pull out my iPad now. I want to read the news, or I need a break from work, so I'm at my desktop browser. You know, you might read the newspaper in many different environments, but you know, one's urgently leaning forward at your desk working, and another one is sitting back on the couch.
Yeah, totally. I mean, I think part of it is that we as creators, we view things in a particular way, whereas people who are users or people who are consumers, they view things in a completely different way. They're technology agnostic, and I think that's how we have to be as creators. We have to kind of say, how are people going to use this? And they're not going to care that, well, let me open this in Firefox and then compare it to Chrome and see how the line heights match up.
Right.
I mean, they're not going to do that. And so I think that's kind of the way that we have to sort of approach things, where the way that we're creating it should be about the person and not relying on dogma that, like, I'm going to set up a grid system and it's going to take me 4 hours to do because this is the way that I need to create. Because the people that are using it don't really care about how many columns you have in your grid. They care about, does it work? Can I use it? How do I use it? Can I share it with my friends? I mean, those are things that are sort of like, we take those things for granted, but we have the ability to really focus on that and tailor an experience to the people using it.
But I was a user when I was on my way to New York Supreme Court trying to get my airline ticket. I wasn't looking at it like as a developer.
Yep, and I think that's a big fail. You know, but I think it's really a tough thing when we kind of straddle the line between being a user and being a creator. So as a user, I think your input was dead on, that like, I can't use this. And then automatically we turn on the, like, why can't I use this? Because it's in Flash, because my HTML doesn't validate, because my CSS isn't written to support this browser. And we go into creator mode again, and then we stop being users. And I think as long as we kind of keep that balance, I think the web will be an awesome place.
By the way, and just to end the story, I found the mobile site for JetBlue and was able to get my ticket, no problem at all. The strange thing about JetBlue is they didn't envision a use case, because I guess it's kind of unusual for a business traveler to have an iPhone. They didn't envision a use case where a business user would try to log on to their $1 million check-in, fail because of Flash, and then go to their mobile site, which actually works for the device. They didn't envision the idea that they might browser detect or feature detect or something like that. We're talking about platforms. We're talking about things that work everywhere, what we call web standards, although if you were at the HTML5 politics panel, we might want to go back to calling them recommendations. And we're talking about proprietary platforms, whether that means the iPad or Flash. Roger, you, interestingly enough, you've been in publishing for a long time, and you saw where publishing was going and saw it going toward the iPad, yet your approach to the iPad was not to go native.
I've never done an iPad app. We're starting on one now. I'm just going to break on that and just say something. I'm really delighted to be here, and I want to say that Jeffrey Zeldman has been a kind of leader and I don't know what you call it, the guru of web standards for me, and I think maybe for other people here. And I just want to thank him for leading the way in this area. You know, I like what you're saying about you got to think about it, what it's like to be a user or a reader, and you have to think about there are different moods or different modes that people have at different times of day, and so there isn't one construction on the best case for an app or a website. But I think as things get more complicated, the web looks just better and better. And if you do everything in HTML5, okay, maybe you can wrap a hybrid app around it and then go to iOS or go to Android or go to any of these other things that look like they're going to happen. But at the same, and there are people who love their apps, and I'm not going to be the one to tell them You can't have your apps. But at the same time, how are we going to support all that if we don't stay with web standards and stay with the stuff that's working so well? So I'm going to show you a quick Tree Saver. If we can switch there, you can go to treesaver.net. It's open source. It's at treesaverjs.com. It's downloadable now. It's semi-documented. The community is growing nicely. And this is the homepage. But here's just one quick demo. This is an AP newsfeed running in HTML that's from the Associated Press. Terribly, it's about news right now. And if you can see in HTML how fast it is. This is, of course, we got decent bandwidth here. But as we go through, there's a dynamic layout that's fitting pictures and text together according to simple algorithms. And that's all done with JavaScript. And I should just a quick nod to Philippe Fortes, who figured this out. So it works on every platform that has a web browser. And it works on every screen. And I'm just resizing it on the fly. So here we're down to sort of iPhone size. And it's the same thing. We page it. It doesn't scroll. We're going to let it scroll later. But if you have pictures that don't fit, you can click on them like any website, and they'll get bigger. It's a very simple thing. The type is from WebType, so you can get your own fonts. It's available now for free, or we can help you figure it out if you need to. So that's Tree Saver. And I really think that this is one solution. It's a reader. It's about engagement. And what we've been able to show with our first metrics, our first analytics, is we're getting, like on this demo with a bunch of geeks looking at it, we're getting 20-minute session times.
Thanks, Roger. I always say the difference between Roger and me is that when Philippe Fortes brought the idea for Tree Saver to Roger, Roger basically started four businesses around it, whereas I would have said, this would be a neat article for a list apart.
And it was.
And it was. That's true. One of the things, Roger, one of the reasons to bank on web standards, when we were just doing web development, when we weren't thinking about mobile, we weren't talking about publishing, there were no iPhones. One of the reasons we did it was, save 25% or more on labor. It's not a very exciting proposition. It's not the kind of thing that you'd like fight someone to the death over. But it was an appealing message for business. Write once, publish everywhere. And that seems to be true if you go with a web standard solution as opposed to a native or hybrid solution, it enables you to do the same thing in the struggling world of publishing. And speaking of the struggling world of publishing, hi, Mandy.
I'll back up a little bit and say I think partly, you're right that some of the incentive for web standards initially was about saving money and saving labor and doing things easier. Designing for so many different platforms was just a huge pain in the ass. But I also think a kind of ethic has emerged from that in the sense that, in print, the designer has kind of total tyranny over the page. Anything the designer does, you as a reader can't escape from if the margins are too small or the type is too small or it's ugly. The only choice you have is to move away and read something else. But what's beautiful about web standards when you completely separate the content and the presentation is that you as a reader actually have the end control. So you can have your own user style sheet and make it what you want it to be. And you can act, you might want an app 1 minute and the web and a website the next, and the next minute you might be on the subway and want to read it, on Instapaper. And I think as someone who consumes content, that is just an unparalleled good. Like that is so much better. And the kind of divergences that we're seeing in apps, I think, can be is in some ways a step in the wrong direction.
You have an interesting background in that you're both at the forefront of new publishing. You're a co-founder of a craft publisher of wonderful books, which I advise everyone to go buy, and you work at Typekit, which is sort of in the vanguard of one of the. Well, it's a company that began solving the problem of type on the web very early and is a very strong leader in that area. Yet you have background. You used to work at a major U.S. publisher, and you've been with traditional publishing. For how many people in the audience are in publishing, one capacity or another? See, I would think every hand should be raised. Okay, I think. How many people here are on the web? Hey, you're all in publishing. Okay, just I used to have a slogan in 1995 when I started doing web publishing. Was the present day content provider refuses to die, and I changed it to the present day publisher after a while because I realized that content producer, like, that's how we think about content. Isn't that bizarre? The whole platform exists for content, whether that's broadcast content or two-way content. It's all about content, and yet that's the last thing we think about when we're designing often.
I mean, I think part of what's interesting about what's going on with publishing right now is that the model has been kind of turned around. If you take traditional publishing, what book publishing has been for the last 150 years or so has been about, you know, publishers have been kind of abstracted from the reader. They're selling to bookstores. They're selling, you know, in the last few decades, they're selling to the heads of Barnes & Noble and Amazon, and they're really far away from the reader. And you're putting books out there in the hopes that communities develop around them and that you can then continue to publish to those communities. And what I think is exciting about A Book Apart and other small publishers who are kind of emerging in this space is that you can build the community first. You know, so A List Apart was around for 10 years. A Book Apart really started with A List Apart, I think, if you reach back to it. Like, it was 10, 12 years ago, however long ago you guys started it. You know, we've been building a community and getting close to that community and publishing to that community for a really long time. And now we're kind of embedded in them and are able to do longer form books because that kind of a community was established. And we're able to be profitable at a time when books, frankly, don't sell for a lot of money and is not necessarily the best business to be starting because we're not going through bookstores anymore.
Funny, because when we started A Book Apart, I said, this is great. So publishing's failing, and we're starting a publishing company. What better time?
Right. Perfect.
But
it is the perfect time to start.
It is the perfect time.
When there's a disaster, it's a great time to jump in.
I started Happy Cog in 1999 at the beginning of the dot-com bust, because I figured after everything settled, there was still going to have to be somebody to do web design. Right?
Right.
And I think one message, one takeaway for everybody here: how many people are of a do-it-yourself kind of mindset? How many, whether it's crafting or, okay, so this is going to be so awesome for you guys. Oh, if you have questions for any of our esteemed panelists, JZ South by Southwest, that is JZSXSW, is the hashtag on Twitter. If you have bandwidth, I think our bandwidth is good right now. I don't know.
Twitter is kind of slammed.
If you guys, you should be so interested that you don't even know if we have good bandwidth or not. But do we have good bandwidth right now? No,
Oh. Terrible.
So you're going to have to pay attention to the panel. But if you do get a moment to tweet a question to hashtag JZ South by Southwest, and we'll start taking your questions. There's also a mic in the back. It looks like a red eye from here. That might be the camera, actually. That's neither a mic nor a camera. Now I'm afraid. Now I'm very afraid. Okay, so we're going to talk about... I want to talk about cluefulness for just a moment. I remember, you know, again, it seems like we're repeating the 90s, but 10 years ago, if we were having this panel, we would have been talking about Clue Train Manifesto and why marketers just didn't get it, man, and all this kind of stuff. And now I feel like a lot of this same kind of discussion is happening to other companies that held out against the internet, namely publishers. One story that I recently read in The Guardian, I don't know who else saw this, HarperCollins is telling libraries that they can only lend ebooks 26 times because they claim, they obviously didn't go to my school library, but they claim that after 26 uses, a book needs to be destroyed. The book is worn out. So after 26 people have fingered its pages, a book needs to be destroyed and repurchased, and therefore, after 26 digital checkouts of a timeless digital book, it needs to. Did anyone else see this? Show of hands.
Now, maybe that's because people have gotten used on the Kindle to annotating their books, and so when they check out a real book from the library, everything is underlined by the 26 times, and they have to throw it out.
It's odd though because yes, you need to be afraid, I guess, if you're a traditional publisher.
Oh, but are you afraid of libraries? Publishers have never been afraid of libraries. So I think that's just kind of like blanket over scared of what's going on. So let's try to, like, you know, make money everywhere we can because on the way down. I think that's the kind of, like, we're just going to kind of grab as we're falling because we don't know what else is going on and we're going to try something. It's, but, you know, libraries don't buy
like oil
huge
companies.
Numbers of books, you know. there's 3,000 libraries in North America or something like that, and you sell 3,000 copies of a really good book, and that's it. You know, that HarperCollins is not going out of business because libraries aren't buying paperbacks anymore.
Yeah. So how do you talk? What strategies do? I mean, Roger, you work with publishers both as a provider of templates. Right? You can provide blanket solutions. You can come in as a designer and provide custom solutions. How do you? And you've been working with newspapers and magazines for 20 years. How do you talk to these people?
Maybe I shouldn't say this in public, but my experience with the establishment media, the print folks that were my old time customers since I was a child, they don't get it. Talk about cluefulness. The big guys are moving in so many different directions and they can't get consensus. And all of the work that we're doing is really for startups. It's or for people who are radically rethinking and doing a kind of spin out of their company and trying to use new platforms for that. And it's all about the web. What's really broken is the business model that they haven't, you know, you talk about HarperCollins trying to ratchet down library sales. The thing is that every single form of media, all the ones represented in at South By, have trouble with their model. And I could start ranting here, but I'll try to restrain myself. The thing is that we can't fix that. They're going to have to fix that for themselves. The question of if you have exclusive great stuff, people will pay for it. Hollywood is the one media type, and we see some real great activity here in the adjacent film festival that does still charge, still has a pretty good business model. It's a pretty small business that they've done pretty well in using the web to promote themselves. The magazines and newspapers have not. And there's an enormous amount of contention about, oh, content should be free and all this stuff. Okay, if you didn't put out such crap, we'd pay for it. And I think that's really the issue. You got to make the product good, and you have to have a good business plan to succeed nowadays in this media.
I would go even a little bit more specific and say that the pricing model is broken in addition to the entire business model. I mean, I think publishers are so old school in general that they don't really get how people are going to consume content in a different way than they already publish it. So, you know, I'll pay $1.99 for an issue of Wired, or I'll pay a $10 subscription for an issue of Wired to receive it in the mail, and they sort of apply that same thing. Okay, well, we'll do the same thing to Wired on an iPad, or we'll do the same thing to Marvel Comics on an iPad, and it's a different type of device with a different type of way that people interact with it, and yet they still apply the same pricing model to that, and it just feels broken. A lot of people aren't willing to take that step.
And I think our consumption of it is more diverse too now. So it used to be you get a newspaper and maybe two if you're really hardcore into the news, and a handful of magazines a month, maybe a few books or something like that. That was kind of like the sole part of your consumption. Now you might read 2,000 blogs over the course of the month, and so paywalls don't work. You're not going to whip out your credit card 2,000 times. And it's partly what readability is trying to solve, is something that's more dispersed and more kind of like frictionless, so that you can read a lot and continue to consume and support all of the writers that you're reaching without this kind of like traditional, like I have to stop and think and pay, because that's a different kind of action that I don't think translates as well.
Another model that's being tried right now by some friends of ours, I don't know how many of you were in the Hilton for about an hour ago for the session by Arc90 and Behavior, but our friends at Arc90 have come up with this thing called Readability. Has anyone used it? The plugin, right? So there's a free plugin called Readability that basically, the history of web design and web content has been, here's my site, I own the content, I push it out at you, and I decide what it looks like. That was the original website model, and then with RSS and all that, and with syndication, that model started breaking down. What people were doing, I mean, where the New York Times was paying for MSNBC, well, now MSNBC's, what do you call it? Mike Davidson's thing. What is that?
Feedburner?
No, Mike Davidson's thing. Newsvine, right.
Yes.
They wanted people to comment on their stories, but they didn't want them to comment on the New York Times because they'd be getting it dirty or something. So they liked the idea that Newsvine was pushing their content out. It's very odd, but we've been going through like all of that with content. Readability takes that one step further and says, you know what, you don't really control the design. Of course, on the web, really, if you read John Alsop, back in the day, Tao of web design, if you knew people who used assistive devices or you use assistive devices, if you had alternate browsers or if you had, if you looked at everything through a text browser like back in the day, you already knew that the people who were publishing didn't control the design, that there
I was reading while we were waiting for this, Frederic Filou, used to be the editor of Liberation, has a column called, a blog called Monday Note, and he was saying, the publishers didn't want this stuff. Why do they hand out all these RSS feeds? And what I think, going back to readability, the thing that readability has shown me is that there is great stuff available on the web, but the business model of most websites creates all this horrible advertising all over it. And it pushes the idea of splitting pages, splitting stories into multiple pages so that you can get more ads up there. And so you keep reloading, and it's just painful. And you hit the readability bookmarklet, and you get something you can read. It's pretty. It even has Typekit fonts in it. It's all cool. So what does that tell us? It tells us that the web doesn't have to be ugly, that the web doesn't have to be a brief, tangential, quick in, quick out experience. It could actually really look great, and it could be immersive and interesting. And I think that that's been the weird thing about the first 15 years of media development on the web. The behavior has been all for aggregation or all for quick transactions, but nothing about the experience.
I think the iPad probably had a lot to do with it. It's not coincidental. Just for anyone who doesn't know readability, you can go to readability.com to get readability, and it's spelled just like it sounds. Readability reformats text on the fly using JavaScript and CSS so that you can look at, you can go, my classic example, I hope he's not in the audience, I certainly wouldn't want to offend him. My favorite, I love the film critic Roger Ebert, but I hate the way his website looks. And when I end up going to read one of his reviews, I can't. But so then I reformat it in readability, and I can. And I just wanted to make the point that one other thing readability does, beside hide the ads and reformat the page, and I know this Timothy Meany was really one of the driving forces behind this, their idea is that they're going to pay for, content is not free, and that they're going to pay for content, but a different way than with advertising. So basically, when you put something into readability, or when you reward it any various number of ways, save it, bookmark it, whatever, the author gets some money from you. It's an opt-in voluntary system where you pay $5 a month or more, and you don't really, and then the money is distributed amongst the authors of, or the publishers of the content that you read.
I think what's really nice about that is you just get to focus on reading. You don't have to kind of stop, and you don't have to worry about how things are going on. You don't have to make a decision. You can just read. It's almost like one click kind of for reading. Like, how many people turn off one click in Amazon because you're afraid you're going to buy too much? I turn it off because I can't control myself. I think it's that kind of behavior. If you make it really easy and frictionless, there's something about that kind of, like, we need to pay for these things, right? We all know we have to pay for content if we want it to be good, but we need that process by which you pay to be kind of transparent and simple and as fast as everything else that we do, as opposed to feeling like a barrier
Jeffrey,
we have to leap over.
Were you starting to say before the readability thing that the apps have actually shown some good design that has kind of been disruptive in terms of the way we look at web design? Is that what you were going to say?
I wasn't going to say that, although that's interesting. Go ahead with that.
Well, I'm thinking, okay, all right.
It is.
I'm not a big app user. You can, I guess I have two pages or three screens of iPad apps. Same thing with the iPhone. I mean, I use them, and when a new one comes out, I try it, and I look at it for a while, and then I delete it. But I do think there's some, like Flipboard, there's some really great design ideas that have happened. And, I know a lot of people are trying to figure out, how do we do Flipboard and HTML? I think maybe Flipboard is trying to do that. And I think the basis of Flipboard may be HTML. So a lot of us are seeing there are some design avails. The idea of a reader of something that, or a video site that's done as an app, could teach you something. So maybe there is some good there.
Apps are definitely disruptive. They do bring wonderful design ideas that can percolate into non-app sites and into content sites. I think to Dan's point earlier, the pricing model is broken because I think the publishers, traditional publishers, said, oh, the iPad's going to save us because You know, people will
CD-ROM saved us back
right,
in the day.
Exactly. People will spend people who already subscribe to The New Yorker will spend $6 every week on The New Yorker and to download 2 gigabytes of stuff on their limited space iPad. And that's not true. But what the iPad did do and what other tablet devices are doing is say in the modern world, there's a relaxed work use. People are working all the time because if they're lucky enough to be employed, they're working like mad and they've got 3 jobs and everybody's multitasking and we have no attention anymore. And it's all about nutrients, really. But we could talk about that in another panel. But the point is that you sit back with this panel and you go, okay, whew, I've been answering email all day long and now to go home and relax, sit on the couch and casually answer my email on the iPad. Right? Okay, and read and all that.
Laying
and I
down
think
with
I,
your feet up. And
so when I said there was no coincidence about readability coming out at the same time, that is, I think readability recognized people love to read on the internet. That's one thing they really do, but it's very hard to do it with all the flashing ads and the ugly layouts and all, you know, and all the fixed width, everything, this, that, and the other. And let's give them a choice of default layouts that are nice to read, that remove a lot of the junk. But if we're going to do that, let's still find a way to make sure that the people who create the content get paid because the stuff's not free.
I think that's I'm sorry, go ahead.
I think that's partly why print is still popular. So like we have the most web savvy audience that you can possibly have with a book apart, but 75% of our sales are paperbacks. And you look at like Simon Collison, who might be here, had produced a newspaper for his conference. That, you know, it was like an actual physical, you know, printed newspaper, very beautifully laid out. There's something about the print experience that I feel like is almost more appealing now that we spend so much time on our computers, because it is this kind of, you know, one track, you can relax, you can just absorb something as opposed to being kind of pulled in all these different directions.
I think that's inherent in digital, I guess, in the idea of digital media, because, you know, before the web was popular and before people consumed content on the web, you would get the New York Times and you would sit down at breakfast and you'd read the New York Times on the paper. You couldn't decide, well, I'm going to piece together this story and this story and this story. I'm going to create my own newspaper. But I think inherent in digital is the Pandora's box that if I can affect it, I should be able to affect everything about it. So I think people are used to consuming content and are getting more and more used to consuming content in their way. And I think that's both really enabling but also really tough on the creator end to maintain. So now you have to create a system where people can customize everything about the content that you're publishing in a way that they want to read it. And I think, you know, I think we're all guilty of that. So for me, I used to read RSS feeds all the time, and it was as simple as I go to a site that I like and I click the RSS button, or I right click and copy the link of the RSS and I plug it into my RSS reader. And then I started to realize that, well, that's not giving me any value because now it's just a bunch of feeds that I haven't read. So I started to use something like Sean Inman's Fever, which was a great way to say, like, here's the kind of stuff I'm interested in. Now you tell me what is best for me to read. And then from there, I stopped reading RSS feeds, and I got all my news through Twitter. And now Twitter is so busy that I'm like, well, I need something to do that for me for Twitter. So I started using this app called Percolate, where every day it pulls in my Twitter followers. I'm sorry, the people I follow on Twitter, and it sends me a daily email that says, here are the top 5 links that people in your network were sharing. And there are all these apps that are kind of like, we can let you do everything, and now I'm asking them to curate for me. So I think as digital kind of becomes the way that people consume content, they have this like Pandora's box of like, we're gonna customize everything for you and allow you to customize. And I think there's a reaction to that in something like, you know, like Simon Collison's paper, where he says, this is the way that I'm going to present news to you. This is the one way, and people get a lot of value out of that curation.
Well, I think there's a problem of abundance, right? And that's not really new. I think it's kind of exponential, but you can go back to the Renaissance and find people talking about how there are too many books and you're never going to be able to read them all. Like, that's not something we've been struggling with for a while. But it gets more interesting in the sense that we keep building these kind of tools that kind of algorithmically tell us, like, these are the things you should read because someone is favoriting it or someone is talking about it or it's showing up in some feed somewhere. And I almost feel like it would be so much more valuable if we could figure out tools that allow more human curation in there. Like, don't just tell me what, like, my friends are most favoriting, but tell me, like, what Dan just favorited, because that's actually more interesting to me at the end of the day. And I feel like some of these tools are kind of abstracting out the people and just giving us the formulas, mm-hmm. and as opposed to bringing people towards it, which I think is more interesting to me.
Well, it's sort of like Pandora versus Ardeo, right? Pandora has this, like, human project where they're saying, we have real humans and real people that kind of go through these songs and classify them, and you're like, well, that's kind of cool. But Ardeo kind of took the same model of serving music, and they said, we're actually going to just make it about your network. So you can find music based on what people you like, like. You know, and so they've sort of taken that model and brought it and kind of gave it a new spin and gave it a little bit new functionality where now you're consuming content and receiving recommendations in completely different ways.
I want to start moving into design because I think a lot of people came here for design. And I think all these challenges get reflected in what we design, what tools we use to design, how we approach design, what platforms we want to design for, or where our frustration points are and where our exciting possibilities are. Your thoughts? No, I'm kidding. But before we do that, I just wanted to try to summarize what we've been talking about to some extent. We're talking about what would probably be called Content 2.0, which is a wretched term, and pretend I didn't just say that. But, you know, people keep talking about Web 2.0 like it's a... Well, they don't anymore. But people would talk about Web 2.0 like, for the first time, the web was two-way. And that's not true. The web has always been one-way and two-way. And now people talk about Content 2.0 like... You know, I want to create an experience that's curated by me, but the problem is I don't necessarily want to create an experience that's just curated by me. Flipboard is great at presenting me a prettily designed random sampling of stuff I'm already looking at anyway, right? Which is different from a curated experience, and it's different from some new hybrid between what editors can do for us and what algorithms and data can do for us.
Flipboard feels like a platform that needs editors. Like, Flipboard does this amazing, it's beautifully designed, it's really, really gorgeous, but it does this amazing thing where it takes someone's tweet about how their breakfast burrito was really disappointing, and it puts this in this gorgeous pull quote that's, you know, that it's beautiful, but it's totally not content aware. But if there was a human being there saying, okay, the breakfast burrito doesn't matter, but this thing that you know, Roger just said, this panel, is actually really fascinating. Let's put that in a pull quote. That's incredibly powerful. But somehow we're creating tools that rely on math and don't rely, and we're trying to use math to replace people. And I feel like we need to bring the people in and bring tools that allow those people to work.
Well, now that there are no jobs, we've got to have something for people to do anyway.
Right.
So I think curating content is a pretty good place to start. I mean,
well, there's a real thing in original content. You don't necessarily know that you know it, you want it. This is definitely true with news. There's no way that you can, like, we could have guessed that this horrible thing would happen in Japan. We really don't necessarily want to hear a lot about it, but we sort of have to. And that's where an editor comes in and where a reporter comes in, and they cover it and put it together. Now, you could get that some of that stuff from the network, and you could filter it with algorithms that could be really useful. I actually think, I mean, what I showed you with TreeSaver, that's designed by algorithm. What if you combine the two? What if you had really great, you know, if Flipboard just put a board of editors up there? It could be really powerful.
I would like to see that platform.
What about Twitter? A curated version of Twitter.
What does that mean?
What does that mean? Yeah, because it's curated.
I don't know.
It sounds like
you're curating your followers, right? By choosing who to follow, I think you are sort of in control of your curation to some extent.
Right. Well, that's Flipboard again. That's Flipboard without the pictures.
Well, I guess that's Twitter list too, right? Like, I follow 800 people. Well, I'm not really interested in what all 800 people have to say at the same time. So now I'm going to create a subset of them, and I'm going to create lists, and then I'm going to have to create subsets of lists, and then I'm going to have to curate those lists, and then find my social network and see who recommends what list to me in what form. And I think, like, it's the same problem, because it is technically a publishing platform, if you want to call it micro-publishing, and it's a publishing platform that eventually will need curation. And then how do you curate that? Do you write an algorithm to curate it? Do you hire an editor for Twitter that will curate your Twitter list? I mean, it seems like it's the same problem, just in a different,
a Twitter
in a different
butler.
Execution.
Well, there's Google, right, which is about data. Let's take all this data that we've got and build a tool that will curate, which might or might not be good. There's the editors who have tremendous expertise in newspapers and publishing, but are having trouble grasping what's happening to them and are responding by saying libraries can't check out these books anymore. So that's not a solution. Pure Googleism isn't a solution. And then somewhere in the middle is everyone in this room, right? Somewhere in the middle is everyone in this room who is responsible for content to some degree, who knows that content isn't free, who, as both a user and a designer, has to make decisions about content.
There's a lot of different models for paying for content that are emerging. There's readability, there's a kind of like subscription service kind of model, I think, that's emerging. There are paywalls that are successful, and there are going to be more, and some of them are going to work.
Who's going to pay for the New York Times when it goes behind the paywall?
What do you do?
Sad.
A few people.
A few people, not many.
Yeah.
who thinks that the New York Times will be free about 6 months after the paywall goes up?
That's a leading question.
You know, but there's also you know, book projects emerging on Kickstarter. There are kind of old-fashioned patronage forms. Sean Blanc has running a drive to pay for him to be a full-time blogger right now. There's a lot of kind of experimentation. There are models like the Deck, which pay for quite a few publishers, but it's an advertising model that's not offensive to the reader, and I think is probably more valuable as to the advertiser at the end of the day. Like, I think there's a lot of room for experimentation, and we're in a place where we don't totally know which of these models is going to work, so we need to just try them all.
We've tried to sell the deck model to every client we've ever done design work for. For the last 5 years, and we've not had one taker yet. I wish we would.
Well, part of the problem too is that the deck can support Swiss Miss, right? Because Swiss Miss is Tina; it's one person.
But the deck supports the New York Times.
But the deck cannot support everyone in that Renzo Piano building in Times Square. It does not scale to that size. And so part of the problem is that you have a Renzo Piano building with, 20,000 people in it working for the New York Times. You probably don't need quite that many people to keep the Gray Lady going at the end of the day.
You said scale. That's a good topic. Everything on the web is about scale. We've got millions and billions of users in China coming up. Google, last year, Doug Bowman was talking about how you couldn't do a curve in Google because at the time, before CSS3 support, that this little 1 billionth of rounded GIF image that was like 1 billionth of a byte times all Google's hits was too much. It would slow down the whole network. So how do things scale? Communities, content sites, how do they scale and not suck? How do they succeed and not suck? Huffington Post just sold for a lot of money and it's very successful, but I don't understand it because on the one hand, it reports to be a journal of left thought. And on the other hand, there are pictures of actresses in bikinis. And it's not presented purely for the gratification of a certain class of reader. And so how can you be both things? It's like having a professor who halfway through a lecture slips on a banana peel and hits himself in the face with a pie. It's like, how can you be both those things? But yet Huffington Post has done that because that's how they made money and that's how they got bought. So does web content have to suck, or does good web content have to be supported by content that sucks, or by ads?
Does it have to be big? Does it have to be a really good scale?
Does it have to be big?
ProPublica is doing really extraordinarily good journalism these days. They're a nonprofit, and they do long-form investigative, long-term projects that are really, really valuable. I'm already paying for ProPublica, and I don't have to. Whereas the New York Times needs me to pay for it because they can't sustain it. I'd rather have 100 ProPublicas than keep paying for, than try to keep this gigantic model kind of going.
Let's go back to that, the expectation that the New York Times will go back to being free. What they're saying, and what I've heard, is that 80% or more of the regular readers of the New York Times won't notice the paywall, that it will be metered in such a way they don't encounter it. So that they can keep that advertising revenue, which is holding. It's not growing much. They don't publish all that data, so we don't really know. But we hear that advertising revenue is now something like 35% of the entire New York Times revenue. That's partly because the print advertising fell so much. So meanwhile, they've laid off people, or they haven't hired the way they used to. It's a smaller newsroom than it once was. What happened? And they have kind of children in Berkeley doing this California edition. What happens with the New York Times if it's not supported by this stuff? It continues to collapse. I mean, we see other papers in places like Austin or Houston, Dallas, and in this state that have really eroded badly. So I think the Austin paper probably does better than most, but the Dallas Morning News is kind of a shadow of its former self. Some people say, "Great, I hated it," but the thing is that if you are going to have this reporting, original reporting in news, it's going to have to be paid for someplace. And if we just got through saying we hate the hideous ads on their website, so now what? If we keep cleansing the ads off with readability, which I do, almost all the papers that I read, I immediately hit the readability button.
Yep.
Because then I can read it. So then what's going to happen? I guess that gets to business, but I think we have to build the expectation of really good content that is worth paying for.
Yeah, I think it's just we have to find models for paying that are easier and less obstructive. I think there are some things emerging. Like ProPublica is participating in the Kindle Singles program. They're selling long-form journalism for a couple of bucks an article. And I think that could, work for something. I think there's a lot of different things that could emerge. I think there's a readability kind of thing that could emerge. I think there are some paywalls that are going to work. I think there are some other things, you know, that we haven't tried yet that someone is trying to be working on right now at this conference. It's going to be really exciting too. And there isn't a single problem with the business model in publishing, so there isn't going to be a single solution. There's going to be a lot of different things come out of that.
Good.
I think the New York Times might be able to pull it off because of their history and their authority as a newspaper, and the people who do read 20 articles a month or more, I think there might be enough of them to keep it going, but we'll have to see.
There's lots of stuff to talk about. It's time to start taking your questions. Nothing's loading on Twitter. The saved searches in Twitter aren't working because we were counting on them. So there's a mic or a large red orb back there. And can anybody see? Maybe we bring the house lights up just a bit.
There's a bunch of people pointing right there.
Mic,
okay,
right there,
ahead.
Middle.
Try to go to the microphone if you can. Okay. If someone's at the microphone, they can speak up now. While you're working your way to the microphone, here are lots of comments. How do you feel about Seth Godin going to an e-book for his latest book and not publishing paperback? Will it help the industry? Is a question from I Wear Your Shirt. Is I Wear Your Shirt here? Just going to have to go, woo! No? Then I guess we don't have to answer that one. Is someone at the microphone? He's back here.
Oh,
all right.
Okay.
Yeah.
I was kidding anyway. Of course we're going to answer. There you go. I publish print and e-books. I don't think that's a problem. I don't think a successful author self-publishing. I think what you're getting at is it okay for an author to self-publish, and does that hurt the industry? I mean, publishing is going toward more of a craft business. I think to succeed, publishers have to be really conscious of their market. They have to really work on making sure that, you know, what they've always done, get the right books for the right audience, but they're going to have to do more hands-on marketing and things like that. I think it's okay for a famous author to try to make more, you know, a higher percentage of money by publishing their own book. But
I think any writer who can self-publish should. If you don't need a publisher, then you absolutely should. And I think that's partly why, I mean, Book Apart has a 50% model, and I think that's really powerful. Like, Jeremy Keith, who's sitting right here, has made way more money off his book than I have, and that is the right model. He should make more money off of it than I have. And I think that's how publishing needs to work. And it's been the other way around, and I think that's a mistake. And partly I have an ethical agreement about that 50% agreement that we have set up, but I also feel like we couldn't have gotten someone like Jeremy Keith or Ethan Marcotte or any of our other authors if we weren't giving them that much, because they can go off and do it on their own. They don't necessarily need us for that.
Feelings toward unity and uniformity. We're just going to keep going because feelings toward unity and uniformity between your web and mobile design. Should that translate to older phones too? Okay, is the question from Trademark? Is Trademark? Say again.
I got a question.
Let's go to the audience here.
Sure. So just take content off the table for a minute. I think there's a lot of opportunity for interaction models to differentiate themselves. I keep getting pay $30 a month to listen to Pandora ad-free, and why would I pay to get something, and when their experience online, the interaction model is the worst ever, that little trying to scroll through my things. If you just provided me with the best interaction to that content, I would be more than willing to pay for it. So I think that there's a lot of differentiation there there's opportunity for.
So better you build a better user experience and you'll get more customers, build a worse one and you turn people off.
That's also, you know, easy trumps free, right? People buy from iTunes. You could BitTorrent every single song that's on iTunes, right? But it's a pain in the ass.
And?
iTunes. Maybe not every song.
Well, it's kind of interesting that going back to that ebook question, we have something to learn from the people next door in the music, that musicians are self-publishing, and they're creating local followings and internet followings that is really driving their traffic at the club dates, and that's where their money is. And I think that the most in the long tail of book publishing, most writers never made very much money. They didn't sell that many books, but they would get a job at the college, or they would get a lecture tour, or make some money doing that.
We have a question here from Hello Fisher. We have 10 minutes. Excellent. We have a question here from Hello Fisher. How do you delight users with your designs? Examples welcome. Since you're hooked up, do you want to take that? Or...
Well, that's really a great question. You know, I think it's everything. I think that you pour yourself into it somehow. It has to be you. And that's like a writer. A really good writer connects directly to one person, and I think a really good designer does too. And if you get that soul in there, if you get a personality in there that seems original or at least focused or hip or whatever you want to do, and it works, you can do it. I think that even in the kind of algorithmic stuff we're talking about, even in the HTML shabbiness of the, you know, the newspaper business model, you can do stuff. And we've seen, you know, people at this conference who have done really great examples of that. But I think you have to put yourself into it. Find a way, either through the code or through the combination of code and the visual layer, to do you.
Jeffrey mentioned that I teach at the Miami Ad School, which is an advertising school that has campuses all over the world. And they're traditionally a traditional advertising shop, so a lot of the students are there to learn how to create print ads and billboards and things that kind of broadcast messages. And so I was brought in to help with their digital program. They realized that students need to learn digital and interactive, and so my class is a 101 class called Digital Campaigns. And my first slide that I presented to them in the first day of class was that you guys are learning how to be advertisers and people hate advertising. So what hope is there for you for a job? And that was the crux of the class. And the takeaway from that is don't advertise, create things that remind people that they're human. So things that make people laugh, things that make people cry, things that make them want to share, things that just make them feel like they are a human again and that they're talked to like a human, or make something that people really like to use. And I think, you know, there are definitely complexities to that, but when you boil it down, it can be as simple as that. If you make something that people like and people want to use, then it'll automatically be good advertising for you.
Wow.
Wish I had known the Zeldman panel was going to be mostly about publishing, would have gone to the type panels instead.
Aww. So should we do type?
Let's talk about type. We have 9 minutes.
Yeah, I think that, you know, Typekit led the way, and we have the opportunity of real typography on the web. My colleague David Verlo at Font Bureau has done these reading edge types, which you can get at WebType, and you don't have to use Verdana in Georgia all the time. And I love that.
I like fonts, too.
Yeah.
There are people in the mic. Please speak up.
I think that, you know, a few years ago, I used to think that radio was about to be totally dead. I'm somebody who grew up learning how to read on a newspaper, took an hour out of every day to read a newspaper. I've even worked for an online publishing company. And you talked about the sensory overload and also a bit about how in order to pay for good content, you have to do this one for one or more like one for three. One good thing gets three junk things. And I found myself driven towards public radio and podcasting, and even the advertising models there were simple sponsorship. It's just this program was brought to you by X. It's surprisingly effective to me. I remember those companies. I feel more loyalty to them. And I've noticed that the blogs that start to emulate that simplicity are more appealing to me. And so from an element of curation, I'd be interested for your opinions on all of this and how to, you know, for those of us who don't want this just blah, 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 you know, flash everything, just want to sort of be able to listen to stuff, not totally in the background, but not be completely going in 80 directions at the same time. You know, what do you think about that and where do you see that affecting, you know, web publishing in the future?
You know, the kind of advertising that's become really offensive that makes us all reach for that readability plugin is, I think, you know, the way that works is the ads have to keep getting more and more annoying so that you actually see them, because after a while, an ad that's annoying in a particular way, you learn to ignore, right? So the ad has to keep ramping up and gets more and more annoying. And the end result of that is the $1 million homepage. It's like a terminal disease. You're going to get to the end there and there's not going to be any content. It's going to be all ads advertising to each other's ads, and it's going to be over. So So I love this kind of revert back, like Dan Benjamin, who does 700,000 podcasts a day, and they're all awesome. And they, you know, he does these small sponsorships that are really human and connected and meaningful and support that project, I think. And I think that's really great. And other kinds of small, you know, deck-like systems that connect advertisers with audience in a way that actually respects the content, I think are super valuable.
Next question.
Hi. So I'm going to go back to the story originally that you had at the very beginning, Jeffrey. You talked about the problem you have with JetBlue and the fact that it was flashing on the iOS device. And I think everybody here assumed that, oh, well, that was boneheaded. Why did you do that, JetBlue? You know, it doesn't support Flash. But I think it's actually a larger problem, right? It's like, well, is it JetBlue's fault? Is it Apple's fault for not supporting Flash? Is it Adobe's fault for not writing something that can work on an iOS device with enough CPU power? Is it the fact that we haven't arrived at web standards yet for authentication and identity? You're signed into TripIt. Why aren't you signed into JetBlue? It's a phone. How, you know, you started out, you know, really champion as a champion of web standards, and as a continuing champion of web standards. I'm wondering what the panel, you know, how do we actually get to a world where that isn't a problem, right? That these apps and these native devices and the native web client, or I'm sorry, the web apps, all talk to each other and communicate with each other.
It's a great question, and my short answer, because we're short on time, is put the user first. I don't know what it's going to take to get all the standards lined up and get all the manufacturers doing the right thing, but if everybody in this room who designs websites, or designs web experiences, or designs apps, puts the user first, puts themselves in the position of the user, does research to find out how users really, really use things. Now, you know, is it Apple's fault for not supporting Flash or whatever? All of that may be true, but you know, should TripIt know to send me to the mobile app? If it knows that I'm already on their iPhone app, should JetBlue's website have a fallback for people who don't support Flash? Should JetBlue's website, you know, if you really put yourself in the user's point of view, what are they trying to achieve? There was another question, then I think that will solve the problem, and that's ultimately what we're all here to learn and to do. And there was another question here about on Twitter about mobile first, and I think mobile first is great too, because if you think about mobile, you're thinking about the simplest things that the user needs to do and putting those first. You're prioritize the user's needs, and that will solve everything else. We have 2 minutes. Is there another question? No.
I want to just say, if you go to the
one hashtag, more question back there.
Looks like. The JZSW hashtag, it's a great meta talk too. They had, or you had, just as good comments as we did. That's for sure.
Last question.
Y'all's points about publishing and everything, and the trend towards individual. You called out Sean Blanc, who's running the membership drive. Do you guys think that the business model of the New York Times inherently, you know, that bloated business model that's not focused on writing, you know, you have to have business analysts, you have editors, you have, you know, all these other people that really aren't contributing to the, or aren't writing in the end, creating the core content. Do you think that's dead? Because, you know, today a guy like John Gruber can make a ton of money just writing a blog on his own, doing everything by himself.
I think editors add a lot of value.
Yeah.
I think the scale is too big. I mean, I'm kind of biased towards small generally, but I think businesses should be smaller. I think when you get to the point where you can't know the name of everyone in your company, you should probably split into a couple of companies. Just in general, I think that large is harder. But I do think that the advertising model for the New York Times, it may not be there. Like, they've been advertising supported for their whole history, right? And so, I don't know that advertising on the web is going to keep that building full.
You know what I think is dead here is that the way that the media, the print media and television had pretty much been taken over as a subset of advertising, so that the editors and the talent were working primarily for the marketing message of their advertisers. I think that's dead. I think that what's happening now is we're getting back to direct connection. And we're looking for original voice, and we're looking for real facts and real information and some fun. And where we find that, if we have to pay for it, if we have to look at the ads, cool. If we can't find that, we go away.
I just wanted to add that we shouldn't compare apples to oranges. John Gruber writing about Apple products in his underwear in his house in Philadelphia is not the same as a reporter going to Egypt and covering a revolution on the ground. That's two different things. It's just so the fact that John Gruber can sit in his underwear and write an awesome essay and make money from the deck ad is, and from his own ads, is great, but it's not the same thing. And so, I mean, it's a real problem. If we lose the newspapers, we lose good journalism, that's a major loss for the world, and then we just have demagoguery and bullshit and branding. So it's important
to say something else because we can't end on that note.
Just so you know, we can't guarantee that John Gruber writes in his underwear.
I thank you all.
Thank you.